Is cybernetics the science that enslaves man to the machine? Is it the ontology for a post-political control society? Or does there exist a minor cybernetics which can embolden the synergies of mass participation and collective empowerment? Welcome back to Zero Repeater. This is Adam from Asset Horizon, and today we are going to be talking everything cybernetic with Dr. James Fox, who has just recently completed his own thesis on the understanding of cybernetic theory in democratic organizations, as well as the prospects for a cybernetics from below. James, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on. I'm really excited to talk to you.
So, first things first, we get what is cybernetics? I guess the first question I'm sort of more interested in is, how do people react to the idea of cybernetics? What sort of caricatures might they have? And in your research, what sort of caricatures have you encountered where people think cybernetics is something, predominantly about science fiction or, the Matrix or the big flying cars and stuff?
I think that is definitely one of the big presumptions that people have who haven't read or looked into it very much. The sort of popular image of cybernetics, I guess, comes from the image of the cyborg and the kind of combination of human and machine imagery is what's often characterized as cybernetics in popular culture. So there's definitely that caricature that comes up a lot. And I think there are some others. There's a sort of caricature of it being synonymous with the sort of surveillance state and like overarching control systems in terms of like social regulation and these sort of forms of like passive control in terms of how like regulating people's behavior and those kind of things. So there's a lot of presumptions about cybernetics that turn people off. And I guess there's often a grain of truth in those, but they tend to very much be simplifications, I think.
For the listeners, James did a talk at the Cover Centre at the University of Essex proposing his research, doing sort of a summary. And one of the sort of, I was wondering if you can give an outline of your project of what drew you to cybernetics particularly and what your project ended up doing in terms of surveying not only people's attitudes, but how cybernetic understandings of the world can help us understand, democratic organisations.
Sure, yeah. I guess when I was attracted to cybernetics as an area, I was kind of unaware of some of those presumptions and caricatures of it. Mm. I was obviously aware of the like cyborg imagery and the sci-fi flying cars type of stuff. But when I started looking into it, I guess I was lucky enough, I think, to first be exposed to the side of it that's more connected to sort of systems theory and these holistic views of how systems operate. And then also some of the work that's been done in cybernetics that's more related to like cooperatives and participatory democracy and these sort of things. So when I first started reading about cybernetics, I was actually really excited by it. And it was only later that I realized that there had been all of this work, a lot of it really, really great work on, cybernetics being the enemy, the sort of totalitarian state machine. I guess I started from more of a positive position with regards to cybernetics. And then later became aware of a lot of the anti-cybernetics viewpoints and this sort of stuff and the controversial aspects of it and really wanted to explore that and was lucky enough to be able to. It was really fascinating.
If people want a good summary of the critique of cybernetics, or the ones that see certain strands of cybernetics at the enemy, you can buy Asset Horizon's upcoming book, Anti-Oculus, coming out from Repeat. But just pulling on that thread a little bit, actually, because in your recent piece on your blog, you talk about these two histories of cybernetics, one that sees it as the ontology of the control society, people like Tikkun would say is an ontology for the end of politics, that just says, you know, we need to trust the plan, in a way, trust the machines, will learn. We just need to figure out the problem isn't what to do, the problem is a matter of information about how we do it. And therefore, there's a sort of a top-down hegemonic way of viewing cybernetics. And you call this a sort of machinist view of cybernetics. I mean, that's also very much explicated in the work of theorists such as, mostly Tikkun, the Invisible Committee, some parts of Foucault. Deleuze and Guattari have an ambiguous relation to cybernetics, both very anti it, but they rely on people such as Gregory Bateson and the like, who extend cybernetics into the field of psychology. And of course, we have, we're on Zero Books, it's cyber theory time. We have Mark Fisher's Flatline Constructs here, very much, and of course, the extended work at CCRU, some of whom will not be mentioned. But in terms of framing it as a question, what you call machinism, which is the sort of this hegemonic view that cybernetics reduces everything to a machine, particularly through a kind of a analogy or isomorphism that they posit between, for example, a computer and a human nervous system. What your project seems to very much explores the idea of a synergism, or what you call common cybernetics. Could you just sort of unpack this idea of a synergism? Sort of going through this. Maybe let's first clarify a bit about the machinist point and where you think the limits are to that, in contrast to the idea of a common cybernetics, a synergism, or say a cybernetics from below.
Yeah, sure. What I would call like machinism, or the negative view of cybernetics from Tikkun and all those kinds of people, I think they're really right in their analysis of cybernetics as it's used by sort of state and capital. Mm. I like completely endorse their work. I think it's really great, but I suppose I just like, it's not that I think that there's something really wrong with their work, or come at it from a critical perspective to their work. I just think the whole paradigm of cybernetics is more than just that, and that's one the kind of hegemonic manifestation of it, which is definitely the enemy that we should try and organize against. But I think when cybernetics as a whole is described as being that, it really misses out a large part of the history of cybernetics and a lot of the other parts of its history, which are kind of ignored from that viewpoint. To try and bring more clarity to that, the last article that I uploaded was trying to distinguish between that kind of control system version of cybernetics and what I call in that synergism, which was just a term that I was trying to think of how to phrase these two things. And I came across that term with this interesting religious connotations, which I hadn't really expected to find. But I just think that division between machinism and synergism kind of draws a line between the kind of version of cybernetics that can be helpful thinking about proposing alternatives to capitalism and trying to produce alternatives. And that's really where it comes from, buffering. So I hope you're, it's fine.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a way of splitting the discourse in two, the kind of good side and bad side. And the common cybernetics idea would obviously be hopefully on the synergism side. And it's just my way of trying to, I suppose, start this conversation and think about how to use cybernetics towards creating more like the types of systems that allow people to self-organize more and to organize outside of this kind of machinic hegemony.
Well, I think it's pretty interesting about how the idea of us using cybernetics as opposed to the sort of more Tocqueville idea of we are used by cybernetic systems or systems that power imposes upon us to regulate us and control us in advance, is that it seems that a project of a common cybernetics really would be to return the political to it. Because, I mean, I was reading a paper, so Facet Horizon, we did another episode on cybernetics a while back, and we was reading this paper and it was talking about the difference between first order and second order cybernetics. And the authors of the paper were so for the listener, first order is more or less just mapping out the territory. The second, in terms of the philosophy of it, first order is when you map out the territory of a feedback system, and then you, second order is you try and go to the squared level of like, okay, think it's like the metaphysics versus physics. You're going to the meta level about this. And the authors of the paper were berating the second order cyberneticists for being too relativistic about the fact that any model you make of a system is a model and carries with it all of the contingencies and presuppositions of the person modeling it. And I was just thinking, well, yeah, that's the good part. That's the point where the politics enters in. Because otherwise you're just replacing the direction of capital or money, which doesn't rot, with information or recorded data, which doesn't rot. And it's particularly interesting thinking about the idea of setting a kind of, I mean, the way I'm trying to sort of articulate it is mostly in the sense of, how do we have a theory of communication with each other, how a theory of self-organization, which doesn't end up sort of getting into this mode of kind of like trust me politics. And this is even interesting for sort of how cyber theory has been on sort of some parts of the leftist intelligentsia, particularly when it comes to stuff like the Manifesto for an Accelerationist Politics, which doesn't really have much politics in it. It's always scorning local self-organizations. What we really need to do is bigger and make a giant think tank that can really sell the communism machine to capital and say, this is a way better machine. You're going to love it. Capitalism's going to be so tempted by this that it's going to trip over its own shoelaces and bam, we've got communism. To see how that went, just look at Paul Mason and, I refute it dustily. But what do you think would be the sort of, I mean, in your studies of democratic organizations, how do you think the principles of cybernetics can help us in terms of articulating political struggles, or at least understanding how political processes work? How do you think the tools of cybernetics can help embolden our discourse, or create zones in which politics can happen rather than trying to automate them out through a sort of preemptive kind of design?
Yeah, I mean, in many senses, cybernetics is a design philosophy and is a way of thinking about how to, like you said, like map territories and design organizations, which is why I think it's so important to insist on adding this political dimension to it, because I don't think it's like boiled into it from the outset. So it's interesting. It's vital to insist on that and to say, the design of an organization doesn't just speak for itself and isn't self-justifying. It needs to be, arguably an allowance for it to be rewritten and dissented from, I suppose. So I don't think cybernetics is political in and of itself. I think it needs to have the politics imposed on it, if you like, from the outside. And that's how I suppose it can be used positively by people to enable their self-organization.
It's interesting sort of looking back at some of the, so my sort of education in cybernetics was more or less entirely out of the work of one guy. It wasn't Staff. I should have done Stafford Beer instead, but instead I sort of found these really incredibly cheap cybernetic textbooks by a guy called F.H. George. And he was at the Brunel University, I think. He was NATO's computing consultant, and he wrote books like, he wrote the Cybernetics and Management, which is a great little paperback, like really classic and pulpy. He wrote Automation, Cybernetics and Society, and I remember reading it was in the management book, and he was writing about how automation is going to change the way that we live, because it's almost like the idea of turning the house into a production line or a conveyor belt, where, you know, it's like food, it's like McDonald's basically. You wake up, your breakfast is gone in the oven, okay, good, it's a conveyor belted out onto the plate, and then you're conveyor belted out after you've eaten it onto the street. And he had this great idea that we're all going to be living in this kind of motel system, we're always going to be constantly in flux. And I was like, well, that would be great if it wasn't the case that actually the rents in London make people do this anyway. this is just the precarity of rent. There's a weird kind of dystopia to the utopian dreams of the cyberneticist arise from this idea that the system will work itself out. And I mean, maybe to even think about some of the political use of cybernetics as it comes to the philosophy that we talk about a lot on Zero Repeater, so, you know, stuff like Mark Fisher and the CCIU and Sadie Plant and the like. Could we talk a little bit about some of the core concepts of cybernetics? Mostly, you know, what would you just, how would you describe sort of negative and positive feedback and their particular ways that they've been problematized in the cybernetic, you know, tradition of thinking, if you can call it a tradition, I guess, because positive feedback is the one that's the most contentious, especially from like the founders of the science, people like Norbert Wiener and the like.
Yeah, I mean, Wiener, I think Wiener is really the person that the CCRU was fundamentally like reacting against, because he had this, obviously he was in the first order tradition. He was very, like, he was the founder of cybernetics, or the term, he was the founder of the term cybernetics. Mm. He named it. And he really saw negative feedback as, like, cybernetics as having to do with negative feedback, essentially, and controlling systems and bringing them into regulation. So he basically reduced cybernetics to negative feedback and this balancing control thing. And if anyone who doesn't know what negative feedback is, it's like balancing if you're riding a bike or something. It's the adjustment of yourself negatively against the tendency that a system is going in. So if you're trying to tilt left, you go right, or like a thermostat is another good example. If it gets too hot, you turn off the heater, blah, blah, blah. Mm. So he really saw cybernetics as that, as negative feedback. And then years later, the CCRU came in and they were like, no, we love positive feedback. It's all been ignored. We want to, you know, accelerate all these technological trends and things like that. And then obviously nowadays that's very contentious and their time has sort of passed. But it's really started this, it's really recontextualized that debate. And I think it's very naive to like sit on either one or the other side of that and be like, no, we want to control everything, or we want to, like, you know, burn everything and let it all explode into whatever it turns into. So yeah, I think it's kind of a bit of a childish thing to sit on any one side of it, and really these are two ways of thinking about how systems operate, which you need to, you know, think about. Fundamentally, you need to think about the goals of the system that you're thinking about and what you want it to do. And that might incorporate aspects of positive or negative feedback, and it can't be one or the other, I suppose. Not sure if I'm answering your questions, by the way.
No, absolutely. I mean, the gamble of the CCRU was pretty much just, okay, the negative feedback, okay, the control systems, it's like an immune system, you know, like something enters the human system, they call it, you know, the human security system, the immune system kicks it out, but actually they believe that there's this latent, like, way of dissembling the unit, you know, this closed unit we think of as the human, the bourgeois subject, and we just need to really, you know, take the fucking brakes off and go the way through it. Sadly, it's for them, they did not realize that it wasn't positive feedback, it was just Thatcherism. There was no speed limit. I mean, this is something we actually, for the listener, if you're interested, it's something that's actually probably dealt with at the most interesting level in Fisher's flatline constructs, as well in Sadie Plant 01s. But we do have the flatline constructs reading group, actually. And if people are interested, they can sign up. We're going to be reading William Gibson's Neuromancer at one point, and held up the poetics of cybernetics speaks for itself in a book like that, because Gibson famously didn't understand the machines. He just used the terms poetically. He said he used the term modem in his writing before he knew what a modem was. And so the aesthetic kick was definitely piloting a lot of them to use a further cybernetic metaphor. But sort of a disjointed question then, regarding going back to the idea of the synergistic or the common cybernetic point of view. I've got a quote from your recent piece here. It says, and you write that synergistic cybernetics looks towards the world and the complex system which it's comprised of, and takes from it whatever contributes to the construction of worlds more aligned with our desires. We do not simply mimic what nature displays, but cooperate it and take from it whatever might be useful to create a world of our own making. And it seems like there's not only a totally different sort of theory of or view of what desire is, when you have to constantly rein it in, but there's also seems a completely different view of nature that's going around here. It seems like the difference between sort of a machinistic view, which is you map out nature's machines and then you sort of basically create a zone of exception around them so you can fight them off, or you can turn the Earth into, you know, what Buckminster Fuller once called like a giant spaceship. He wrote the Manual of Spaceship Earth. The synergistic view seems to have a different view of nature here. Predominantly, it seems to be like a politics of nature. And I guess I wanted to ask about what the role of nature, you think, what sort of view of nature has dominated traditional ways of thinking about cybernetics, and where yours might differ, and particularly when it comes to the idea of negotiating with nature, because the whole tradition that we call ecology is, you know, people might not know this, the ecology is a cybernetic discipline. You know, Gaia theory, for example, one of the theories that comes out from James Lovelock, literally just you open up the chapter, boom, it's cybernetics. So I just wanted to ask a bit about the naturalistic implications of what you're working on.
Yeah, so I suppose the caricature, the kind of sci-fi caricature of cybernetics that we were talking about at the start, I guess that has really been followed not just in like pop culture and the aesthetics of cybernetics, but also in this sort of in the kind of hegemonic machinist view of it. And yeah, I think it is a caricature and it is reductive of what cybernetics is, because if you look at a lot of the texts on cybernetics, like you just mentioned a few, there are really different types of systemic metaphor at work in those. And it's not just to do with this machine metaphor. There's also a lot of metaphors about like networks, you know, more based on this kind of computational thing. But importantly, like you just said, there's also a lot of use of like ecological metaphors and biological metaphors and metaphors from living systems. And I think really that makes up more of it in my experience than the machine stuff. But it's been sort of really reduced down to this caricature of it as being all to do with machines. But yeah, cybernetics just has to do with complex systems. And the whole point of that term being open is that it can be any complex system. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the complex systems that we can look at in the world, I mean, the most obvious ones are biological systems, ecological systems, organic systems of whatever kind. And they have just as much of a role in cybernetics as these machine metaphors. So yeah, I think we can look to all kinds of complex systems, whatever they might be, and try to draw out of them things that might be useful for, you know, creating more self-organized systems that can operate outside of the kind of hegemonic, you know, outside of capitalism and the state, I suppose. I'm just trying to think if there was another thing in my brain or not. Go on.
Well, if I could pick up, so what I think actually really interesting, actually, in what you were just saying was regarding you kept using the term metaphor, and it's, I got, maybe it's just because I'm too surrounded by Deleuze Ogatarians and I'm teaching this, but it seems that that's actually quite a break with a lot of the philosophy that's engaged, or particularly how a lot of the philosophy, mainly coming out of France in the mid 20th century, talks about cybernetics. Because, or even to go back to Wiener, I mean, in The Human Use of Human Beings, Wiener does say there are limits to this, but it, in terms of the action of designing systems or mapping out systems, it's almost like sometimes that they don't treat them as metaphors. For example, the idea that the human nervous system, you know, they treat them as isomorphisms, you know, that they're translatable. Then if you map out, if you do like a diagram of an image system, same way that if you do a diagram of a thermostat, you've got sort of a basic negative feedback loop system that you can move on to a bike, you can move on to a, you can move on, of course, to a, most famously a boat, because, you know, Kiberios pilots. It's, would you say that, the rejection of metaphor is something that's common in how like people think of cybernetics outside, or how cyberneticists may think of it outside of philosophy? Mm-hmm. Or would you say that the admitting that it is a metaphor, it's not an isomorphism, it's not an equivalence, do you think that's where the part of the real danger leads when you're splitting it between an apolitical or anti-political machinist view or a more political synergistic view? Because it seems like in the machinistic hegemonic view, it's, there is no metaphor. It's all collapsed into the same flat plane. Because, you know, if you automate a factory, if you replace a worker with a machine, you can draw a diagram of the factory and you can change the name of one node. But as long as the worker and the machine are doing the same thing, they're playing the same function, they're fundamentally interchangeable. So does the introduction of metaphor actually provide a kind of a backstop against this flattening?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I would agree with you that often the emphasis on metaphor isn't really emphasized in quite a lot of those texts. And I guess I kind of, it seems obvious to me that a lot of the time these are metaphors. And I, in a way, I haven't really reflected all that much on my use of that term. But I completely agree that they are sort of conveyed as isomorphisms. And I suppose it goes back to that insistence on inserting a politics into it, and I'm losing my train of thought. You brought up a really good point, but
it's fine.
I think you're totally right that that's where a lot of the damage, where a lot of the danger of cybernetics comes from, is when you don't treat these things as having a sort of a metaphorical component to them, but also a like deliberative component to them, and or a side of them that it's like a subject of debate and discussion. It's not just something that speaks for itself. Systems never really speak for themselves, and they always demand interpretation. And too often, I think, in cybernetics, they are treated as just simple isomorphisms that speak for themselves. And yeah, I'd agree. That is definitely where a lot of the danger comes in. And I suppose my use of the term metaphor, without even really realizing it, is a way of trying to force politics into cybernetics.
I mean, that's actually a really good way of doing it. I mean, because that's kind of the limit of saying, no, the map isn't the territory. It's sort of looking at all of the ways in which sort of cyber theory has gone. This is great. If we draw a diagram, if we look at these things, abstract machines, we can plug into them. And we can, but the metaphor actually, even if the metaphor isn't itself metaphorical, even if the metaphor is just, itself like a functional stand-in for the ways in which we exceed cybernetic mappings. We're always kind of, flowing out of it. What Deleuze and Guattari would call like having a surplus value of code, or, a line of deterritorialization that capital can't contain. It's still worthwhile to insert that there, because otherwise people just uncritically accept stuff. I mean, so on Asset Horizon, we just have a video on AI, when people call it AI and it's almost like it's the discussion around AI, for example, is more like, okay, AI implicitly exists. It will exist. It inevitably will exist. And therefore, we have to act as if it's there. And we don't act metaphorically like AI is something that could exist in the future in this sort of speculative kind of way, but actually is act as if it's dormant. And this is where you get such, ludicrous ideas that if we don't accelerate its arrival into being, given it's inevitable, it will somehow punish us. Which is more of like, the Pascal's wager for collaborating with the Borg or something. But I just really want to highlight the ideas of metaphor there. But let's think about one of the tools in which you sort of highlight as one of the ways in which we can talk about a common cybernetics, in the idea of providing a common toolkit of cybernetics for everyday organizations. And you mentioned something called the Whole Earth Catalog. Could you tell me a bit about the Whole Earth Catalog and why you think it was so fitting for that? As an illustration of what common cybernetics could be.
Yeah. So the Whole Earth Catalog was developed by a guy called Stuart Brand in the early 60s. And it was like a catalog made up of all kinds of things, very eclectic, and had all kinds of stuff in there. So it had a lot of like do-it-yourself DIY little guides and processes in there. There are a lot of things being sold in there and publicized and exposed to people. But it also had a lot of text about cybernetics and systems theory and how all these things connect together. And it was this really eclectic text full of just all kinds of stuff. A lot of it very associated with the kind of, the 60s self-sufficiency, hippie kind of vibes. So it's just a really interesting text, I think, really interesting catalog. And there are a bunch of them. The first one had an image of the Earth, which I think was the first image of the Earth that was the entire Earth, not like a composite of different pictures. So it connects to this holism angle that they were coming from. So when I was like looking at digital versions of the Whole Earth Catalog, it really struck me that this was the kind of eclectic drawing from all together, a kind of toolbox that could be used to enable the kind of self-sufficiency, self-governance, self-organization that I think is illustrative of what could come out of a common cybernetics in an ideal world. But in another way, I do think I I think the Whole Earth Catalog really is an amazing thing, and I do really love it as an idea and think it is very illustrative of the kind of thing I want to suggest as something that could be helpful for us. But I think maybe in a way I relied on it a little bit too heavily, in that Stuart Brand later, like a lot of people from that generation, did like amazing, really fascinating stuff in the 60s. And then by the end of the 70s was like doing big consultancy things for major corporations and was getting in bed with like, what's he called? Apple man.
Steve Jobs.
Steve Jobs and all that kind of stuff. So I don't endorse the person or what he became, but the Whole Earth Catalog was a really, really fascinating thing and a great exemplification of this kind of toolbox of self-organizing tools, techniques that I think making that kind of thing for the 21st century, I think could be the sort of thing we need to be able to go from just imagining alternatives to actually building some of the stuff, I suppose.
The idea of a catalog is very like interesting to me, because I mean, in the Asset Horizon book, we have a catalog as one of the chapters, although it's very much a catalog of like, you know, if do you want to do social control, here's the machines for you. It's basically, you know, what if Deloitte did like, I mean, I say there's historical examples of this. I mean, IBM famously provided a lot of computing, which enabled the Nazis to commit a lot of their crimes. Ian Allen Paul's great work, Our Computers Prisons, is good on this. I mean, the DSM, a Diagnostical and Statistical Manual, might as well be like a whole psyche catalog. And it's very interesting that this is a very first order psychic thing, the idea of mapping everything into a catalog. So, okay, this goes here, this goes here, this goes here, and you can sort of use it and recombine it. And I think it's almost like the recombination point, maybe, is probably a bit more important than the mapping itself. It's almost like you need some like blank pages at the end of a book like that, so you can fill it in here. Basically, like this, because it has to be some sort of space for collectivity there. Because otherwise, you're like, okay, here's a book of definitions, and there's yes, definitions are useful, they're repeatable, but then there's like a sovereignty of the text there, and maybe writing could be one of the problems with a lot of classical cybernetics, in the sense of there's an authority of the book. Here's the book, we've written down the book. Now just go and apply it. And don't worry if, you know, is there a risk there? Don't worry, the machines will learn, because we've defined them as learning machines, and you just have to feed them more data, it'll get better. You know, there's an implicit politics of data in a lot of this, which relies on something which, in your recent talk, you highlight as being sort of one of the real problems for cybernetics, or to presenting a new kind of cybernetics today, which is that as a design philosophy, there's this, I mean, there's a tendency, one, to act as if it's not a metaphor, because, you know, we could get there. We just need more time. You don't want to throw it all away. And it's itself a positive feedback loop of, shit, okay, we invested so much time into this, we're just this close, and then, bam, something horrible happens, or the startup collapses, and the like. But there's a politics of trust there, or parts of trusting in the system, trusting in design, and sort of trusting in each other. And you mentioned this in the talk, that one of the real issues here is finding spaces of sort of, one, cultivating a sense of political trust, but more interestingly, finding spaces where you can dissent against the current model. And you draw on a lot of the work of Jacques Rancière on this. I was wondering if you could unpack the idea of using cybernetics to to help generate these spaces, or at least understand spaces of what you call spaces of dissent when it comes to organization, as opposed to, you know, kind of a top-down thing where essentially you're just, in a sense, milking people for feedback. It's like, yes, okay, you know, you need any productive feedback. No, that's not signal, that's noise, go away, and so on and so forth.
Yeah. Like like we were saying earlier about the politics of it, I don't think that's something that is built into cybernetics from the outset. So the idea of dissent and insisting on adding dissent into the way these participatory organizations are designed is something I think is important to stop those systems from ending up dominating people, or just stopping the people who are in control of those systems or can talk about them the most eloquently from ending up controlling the systems. So the idea of dissent isn't something that comes from cybernetics. It's something I think that, like on top of cybernetics in order to prevent it from eliminating politics and automating organization, I suppose. So yeah, I think Rancière's work is really useful for thinking about how to keep a space for dissenting from an organization, or just keeping it able to be changed and adjusted. I guess much like the thing with we just talked about catalogs, and I said like a Wikipedia might be a better version of that. Although Wikipedias can actually have a lot of that, you know, can have their own little hierarchies and stuff. A wiki is different from a text in that it can be revised and changed, and you know, people can dissent in a certain way. They can say, "Oh, like this is wrong. I'm going to rewrite this." Keeping this openness to dissent and change, I think, is really fundamental to these systems not becoming oppressive. And just to say another thing, because you said maybe like another really interesting thing, like about maybe writing is the problem here or something, and you know, and that reinserts this kind of authority of the cybernetician or whatever. And that's like a really interesting point for a number of reasons. I think connects to the dissent thing, but in terms of like defining what cybernetics is, there's the kind of conventional way of defining it is to do with finding and articulating like commonalities between all kinds of complex systems and this sort of thing. But there's another definition, or another way of thinking about what cybernetics is, which comes from this book by Andrew Pickering, called Design of the Brain. Or am I misremembering? I think it is. But he does a really great history of like British cybernetics, and he defines cybernetics in a really different way to how it tends to be in a lot of the books, and he calls it like a performative ontology. And he basically thinks of cybernetics as not to do with this kind of writing and articulation of how systems work, but for him, cybernetics has to do more with like the practical design of actually making a system, and the system that you make, as opposed to sort of write, that system or thing that you make kind of demonstrates a hypothesis, or through its activity, it kind of speaks for itself in a certain way. Like there's Ross Ashby made these little robot things that he called a homeostat. And this is one of the examples that Pickering uses, that like the homeostat was his model of how, like, what a brain was and how a brain behaved. And really, that physical, like, machine in that case of the brain said more than, you know, him writing about what a brain was. It was like, this is a station of the thing, of his theory. It's like a physical embodiment of the theory. So, yeah, what you said about writing really made me think of that. So, yeah, a lot of cybernetics does have to do with making stuff rather than writing stuff, I suppose.
I mean, there's a tradition of musicians involving sort of cybernetic ideas as well, which you bring up in, I think, one of your pieces, isn't it? Brian Eno? It's like a cybernetic musician of sorts.
Yeah. He said that everything he wrote after, I think, Music for Airports, he said, like, everything that he's made since then, including that, has, like, is completely informed by cybernetics. And he was a good friend. He became a good friend of Stafford Beer's thing later on. And apparently he read Brain of the Firm, which was this book by Stafford Beer about, like, managing large organizations through his viable systems model. And he says he read this book and, like, intuitively, like, it taught him an entire philosophy of how to make music through reading this book about management, which I guess is an amazing example of the sort of metaphors of cybernetics and the places they can lead.
It's always interested me how the term cybernetics has been kind of reduced into management studies. Like, you see most cyberneticists end up in kind of like business schools and management departments, or even like some philosophy, you're talking about organizing itself has been subsumed into the ideal of management, which I guess maybe exemplifies the machinist tradition, but also in this more undercommonsy kind of sense, you know, lets some more critical or leftist cybernetics end up in. And we've seen that with the great work, of course, of the cover center over Essex. But there's one point where, just going back to my own experience as a musician, the idea of feedback is very much, it's much more different and practical in music than it is in, say, in writing a text. I mean, writing a text is, if you're an academic, you are essentially a completely well-rounded Wienerian negative feedback machine, because you write something and you try and hedge all the possible objections you're feeding forward to get rid of all the objections a possible reader could have. The supervisor reads it, send you negative feedback, and that negative feedback feeds back in into how you try and feed forward and preempt any other objections. And I'm working on something at the moment about cybernetics and writing and viruses and stuff like that. And as we are just constantly writing more than ever before, our phones are writing systems. And what's interesting about stuff like Twitter, for example, and social media generally is, it's accelerated the process of feedback on writing. So you can write something, you know, I write something to my supervisor, wait a week, or wait a few days, or back in the day, you did an exam, you try and preempt all the things that the marker is going to find wrong with it. You send it off, a month, 2 months later, comes back. Worsening labor relations in education means it might take longer or quicker because people are forced to work on it, and big ups to marking assessment boycott that's going on soon, if not right now, from UCU. But with social media, feedback is instantaneous, more or less, or quicker than before. So you can write something and suddenly you can get very positive feedback in the sense of both, one, little hearts, two, it starts being retweeted, it starts spreading like a contagion, it goes viral in a very literal, possibly even non-metaphorical sense, or negative feedback when it does have positive feedback and it's spiraling out, but everyone on the internet is mad at you and you're the main character for the day. It's text is very much a domain of the cyber theory that I guess we're used to reading because it's text, or even they're used to discussing about here. But when it comes to music, it's So I'm a noise guy. You know, I did a lot of industrial noise stuff, and sort of the very idea of a feedback loop is completely distinct from the manner in which it's thought of in cybernetics, which is it's noise, it's not signal. It's not signal that's, but you nonetheless still learn from the noise, but not in any sort of conscious way. Like, okay, it's more effective. I like this sound. I'm going to negotiate with the machine that's making the sounds, put it through various filters and the like. And it's more imminence than the imminence that's being sold to you through a text, which is, yes, it has an author, and yes, the author is dead. You know, the author died of a cybernetic virus years ago, but there's still the lingering specter of authority hanging about there. So I really think the pragmatic aspect is something that I'm really glad you highlighted that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's a really interesting point. And yeah, that relationship with noise and that more, yeah, like embodied relationship with a bunch of like equipment that's making a load of noise. Yeah, no, it's a really interesting thought. I guess you draw stuff out of that noise, right? Even if it is really just experiential and not something you can articulate in words. Yeah. Noise music is really interesting.
It's call and response, but it's not necessarily registered at a textual level. Or even to say that you can have the text of lyrics which can have a similar event, like effective and pragmatic dimension. And then you've got models where it's like, actually, that's another good point to bring up, actually. Considering the idea of cybernetics in sort of a hegemonic and non-hegemonic way, one question that's sort of hovering over this, actually, is the question of, and it doesn't need to be a flat binary, but I'm just going to posit it as one that usually comes up discursively, of centralization versus decentralization. Because even in sort of leftist politics, one of the You can map it cybernetically, and therefore it's a cybernetic system, but maybe they weren't thinking about this. And this is actually a good way to get into a question about Bogdanov and textology. When that's democratic centralism, which is the idea that, you know, you have all of these debates, and through this a composition is formed, and then you stick to it, or else, you know, it's it's a centralized party system. Unity in action, but nonetheless sort of a constant sort of barrage of different kinds of processes, or different, for example, different party cadres. You're working on this bit, you're working on this bit, we'll all educate each other mutually, and then we'll get together, have a big vote, and centralize, and that centralizes it into one political will. Whereas a more decentralized version, probably something like some sort of network or federated anarchist system. I don't even federate it, but simply the process of negotiation between different communes. I'm not going to lay out a whole theory there because I'm not as read up on it as I am from my slightly more Leninist days, which are probably a bit behind me now. But yeah, I really think it's interesting to think about this centralizing versus decentralizing dynamic. So I guess my first question would be, what is your perspective on this dynamic? Is it a false binary? Is it, as the Leninists would say, and Marx would say, very dialectical, and they're mutually interdependent? And I guess after that, maybe we can. I guess a question of who was Bogdanov? Who was the lost scion of Soviet cybernetics?
Yeah. Well, I do think that it is a false dichotomy. And Stafford Beer certainly did, and he talked about that a lot. There are many kind of false dichotomies within cybernetics, or the way that we talk about systems, which I think cybernetics can be really good for kind of bringing about some useful, complexifying them in useful ways that can bring about more clarity. But yeah, I think Beer really saw that as a false dichotomy, and I think really in any functioning system you need to have both some and points of decentralization, and in his like viable systems model, there's kind of horizontal axes of control and more vertical ones. Although he thought about vertical control in a very particular way that we probably shouldn't completely unpack here, but it's not just having like a party hierarchy or something like that. There's this distinction between functional and logical hierarchies, which is really important and informative, I think, in that regard. For Bogdanov, I'm definitely not an expert on Bogdanov. I'd like to be. He's really fascinating from what I've read. But yeah, I haven't read that much, so I'm not like an authority on Bogdanov. But my understanding is that, yeah, he wasn't this, in terms of his role in like with the Soviets and all that, he wasn't gunning for more and more centralization by any means, and it ended more on the opposite. And I think if history had gone in a different direction, and his sort of butting heads with Lenin had led in another direction, I think maybe the whole history of the Soviets could have been very, very different and would have been a lot more bottom up. Like he was influenced a lot by these biological metaphors and stuff, and really saw that within like organic systems, the activity really starts from below and goes upwards rather than starting from the top. And, you know, the people, the wise people, you know, coming up with the perfect system and directing it downwards. So I'm not an expert, but I certainly think if he'd come out on top of the kind of conflict with Lenin, I think I would, I'd be much more sympathetic with that whole period of history and what ended up happening there.
The Soviets didn't really get cybernetics until after Stalin, because it was officially branded as like a bourgeois science, wasn't it? And particularly they don't really get, something Adam Curtis goes on in his latest documentary, Trauma Zone, the idea that sort of the main sort of selling point for Gorbachev was, okay, we just got to cybernate, that is, automate, communicate everything, and then it'll be fine. It wasn't. I mean, there was a weird system of, they were just trying to get feedback from people. You know, okay, what do people want? Okay, they want blue jeans. Okay, let's make fucking 10 million pairs of blue jeans. By the time you go back to people, okay, we've made the blue jeans. They go, oh, it's out of fashion now. And then they've just got warehouses full of the shit that nobody wants. And it seems like the problematic there isn't like, okay, what do you want? Okay, the brain geniuses of the Presidium and Soviet Union are going to give it to you. No, it has to be kind of fully horizontal, or at least from below. And it has to understand the production of desire as well as the desire for production of something interwoven and linked. But it's, I mean, yeah, we can get into a whole history of Soviet cybernetics here, but it's probably best not to, because it's, you know, if listeners want to check out any of the sort of early influences on Soviet cybernetics, especially at Bogdanov, people should check out the Acid Horizon Russian Cosmism episode. We talk about Fedorov. He doesn't really survive to the end of the episode, to be honest, but it's nonetheless quite a fascinating account of some of the early accelerationists and where things go a bit tits up, to put it, you use a technical term, of course. Okay, so one last question, because we're just coming up to the hour. Where would you say, Pete, if people wanted to sort of cultivate some of an interest in cybernetics, where do you think would be the best place for them to start? Would be the best intro?
That's a good question. There's like a load of different answers to it, depending on what you what you're trying to do, I suppose. If you want like histories or like overall, if you want like histories or overviews of what cybernetics is, I think Fritjof Capra's book, The Web of Life, was like the first book that I read that that really set my mind racing about all this stuff. But he's very much coming from a kind of scientific systems theory kind of perspective. Andrew Pickering's book that I mentioned earlier is also like really excellent for that kind of historical overview. And there's loads of others. And like we were saying, cybernetics has many different histories to it. So you can't really get all of those histories in one place. There's a book called A Guy Called Something Rid. I'm very bad with names. It's Rid, R-I-D, called Rise of the Machines, which I suppose gives a really good history of the machinism side of it, roots in like special military and preparatory and these sort of things. If you're coming at it from more of a political angle, Tikwin's cybernetic hypothesis is really great for like a critique of hegemonic cybernetics. John Walker did a really good short guide to applying the viable systems model to cooperatives. That's a nice read. Anarchist Cybernetics by Thomas Swan has recently come out. And that is probably the best place to go for a view of cybernetics from below, really, in the form of the book. He's really great. Thomas Swan's great. I could list off loads of other things. Don't mean to plug myself, but on one of the things on my Substack called Common Cybernetic Resources, at the bottom of that, in one of the notes, there's a load of texts that I recommend in like different aspects of this history. So if you want to have a load of, like if you want a reading list, there is one there.
I mean, I was about to ask if you was going to plug the blog. So this is perfect. Now, these things are built for plugging. You know, plugins. The Turing police are not going to. I was going to say, where can people find you? Where can the Turing cops come find you? No, it's fine. This is all good. I'll absolutely link James's blog in the show notes. It's called Tectology.
Yeah, Tectological Serendipity, I think it's called.
Name. It's the Bogdanovites name for it, and it's far nicer than cybernetics because the cyber, the head, the brain, the pilots, it's all very Plato. Then again, maybe this is a Deleuzian semiovirus rewriting my brain. But with that said, James, thank you so much for coming on to Zero Repeater.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really, really fun. And yeah, it's been great. Thanks so much for having me.
We appreciate your support of the imprint and the channel. Subscribe to Zero Books today on Patreon. Your material support helps us to promote a variety of perspectives on the left. Also, discover the many titles, new and old, that Zero has curated. Navigate to any of the links in the show notes to extend your support.